Have you ever wanted to work in a flying ICU? Or maybe you're just passionate about saving lives. Right now you can realize your dream by applying to work for one of the best teams in the air medical industry. Air Methods is currently hiring qualified flight nurses, medics, and mechanics to join our air medical team. Check out our new salary and benefits packages. Visit airmethods.com/careers and apply today. That's airmethods.com/careers.
The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and FlightBridge Ed in their entirety.
Hey everybody, Eric back with you. Today is going to be a reminder of how we evolve as clinicians. If we think back at the early parts of our career, I would bet that we were all very thorough. We took every patient very seriously. But over time, based on complacency, based on seeing the same patients over and over and over, we start having cognitive bias. And I would say that one of the highest risk areas in medicine, let alone pre-hospital EMS, is cognitive bias that stops us from being thorough. Well, what is cognitive bias? Essentially, this is just a strong preconceived notion of something or someone. It's usually based on information we have, maybe that we perceive, or maybe it's a lack of information. And these preconceptions are essentially mental shortcuts that we have built that our human brain produces to expedite information processing. This helps us quickly make sense of things that we're seeing, and we're able to process that information very, very quickly. Now, that doesn't sound that bad, and I think we do this subconsciously based on our perspective in life and in specific situations. But are we so programmed in medicine? We see so many of the same patients. We see patients that we would classify as system abusers, that cognitive bias gets in the way of us making good, sound decisions. What if I said you will not make a diagnosis of any disease that you didn't include in your differential? And that's a strong statement, but I challenge you to that thought. And that's why the title of this podcast is "The Eyes Don't See What the Brain Doesn't Consider." Again, the eyes don't see what the brain doesn't consider. I first heard this. I don't think this is a new concept, but I heard this from my wife, Ashley, and she had quoted Dr. Jeff Jarvis, our chief medical director. And I started really thinking about that saying. It hit me. And so this podcast is a reminder. Do we understand the impact of differential diagnosis? One of the things that I've always tried to encompass in my differential is the rule of threes. Every presentation that my patient has in front of me, I want to be thinking about three potential differentials. And then based on those differentials, I ask questions throughout that history taking that is going to lead me down a specific road. I have three different scenarios that I want to go through to highlight the importance of this. Our first one is a 40-year-old male, has a witness syncope episode. He is unresponsive per bystanders for about 45 seconds. When you arrive at his side, you are told by him, he has got a GCS currently of 15. He says, "I just passed out. You know, I've actually passed out quite a few times over the last few months. I just don't think I'm drinking enough water." He denies any medications. He denies any allergies. He also states that he has noticed positional dyspnea at night, but states that he had pneumonia a few months back, and he has just chalked that up to secondary effects to that pneumonia. So when we think about syncope, and we think about a 40-year-old male, do we start going down the road of cardiac, of neuro, or do we immediately, based on the age, lean more towards something very benign? And I would say age has a lot to do with how we react to specific presentations. We all have seen, though, young males in their 30s, 40s die of sudden cardiac death or have big, massive MIs. So we have to learn to be very thorough and think about this patient from the standpoint of any syncopal episode with somebody 40 years old needs to be treated seriously. And so this patient needs to be worked up for a cardiac cause. Definitely needs to have blood pressures done. I would do blood pressures in both arms. I would want to make sure that we do a 12 lead. Discuss different parts of his everyday life. If this is suddenly started, does he have any past medical history that would lead you down a specific road? Did he have any cardiac-related anomalies as a young child or an infant? What types of questions would you ask somebody with potential neuro involvement or simple volume loss? So the point is you need to thoroughly investigate those three areas or anything else that could elicit a patient having a syncopal episode. So we'd perform blood pressures on both arms. They're equal. Blood sugar is normal at 92. He is in a normal sinus rhythm at about 85. He is a non-smoker. He seems to be in good health. You take him into the hospital and you follow up with the ED a few days later and identify that the patient did have a new onset murmur identified. Labs were ran. Labs were absolutely normal. There was no elevated troponin. CKMB was normal. All liver enzymes were normal. There was an echo performed, and through that process, they did identify a new onset aortic insufficiency. And the patient was then referred to a cardiologist, and follow-up care was started. So the point of this is things aren't always what they seem. If you remember the podcast we did last year called The Second Fracture, we have to, again, be very, very careful not to put ourselves into these tiny little silos. We have to be able to move through our differential and move from cardiac, move into neuro, move into volume loss, or any other presentation that warrants a look at a different differential diagnosis. Let's look at the second case. We have a 42-year-old, I'm not going to state the gender at this point, with consistent diffuse abdominal pain, states that it aches, and it started about 16 hours ago. They state that nothing makes it better, nothing makes it worse, it's just always there. There's associated nausea. They state that they've had two episodes of vomiting that is bilious in nature. No recent illness, no cough, no congestion, no radiation of the pain. It just sits there. No urinary symptoms. And they are currently afebrile. So again, you have diffuse abdominal pain. Just automatically, anybody with abdominal pain, that should raise 1,000 red flags. And that is one of those diagnoses that is extremely difficult. There are so many different factors that play into abdominal pain and our pain receptors in those areas. Remember, in your abdomen, in those areas, that is going to be a visceral pain, and you have a lot of referred pain. It could be so many different things. So we could quickly go down our questioning. Remember that anybody that's having ketone production That can cause nausea. That can cause vomiting. So a blood sugar questioning about diabetes would be warranted. Cholecystitis. Does the patient have a gallbladder currently? Any increase in that dull pain after they eat? Any referred pain into the right shoulder? We go into pancreatitis. You could look at appendicitis, acute hepatitis, or we could even look at it from a small bowel obstruction. Now, if we start looking at this from a gender standpoint, any patient, any woman, I should say, of childbearing age, could it be a cyst? Could it be pelvic inflammatory disease? I would say no. And the reason why is this presentation is very dull in nature. It's an ache. It doesn't move. And when you look at cysts, when you look at PID, you look at those types of problems in that childbearing age woman, those are very localized in nature. So throughout the overall assessment, it was found that this patient did start on some Bactrim a few weeks ago, doesn't have any past medical history or medication use per se, but the diagnosis was actually acute pancreatitis secondary to Bactrim administration. How would we deal with this patient in the pre-hospital setting? Again, anybody with abdominal pain, ache. I think I would probably lead more to doing a 12 lead on a female because of that atypical presentation. But I think we've learned that it is not a bad way of assessing and managing any patient when you have any abdominal syncope, any nausea, vomiting, any atypical presentation like that, we should be doing a 12 lead. You just never know what you're going to pick up. And so when we think about this patient, diffuse abdominal pain, we're probably not going to do a lot of different things. We're going to check a sugar. We're going to get a good history. We're going to go down our differential, do our 12 lead, manage the patient as best we can, maybe give some Zofran. But really, nothing we're going to do is very sexy in this type of patient. The point of this scenario is just to give us the ability to understand that some of these presentations are so vague, they go so many different directions, and we have to be very diligent in asking the right questions and moving down our different algorithms. Now let's do another case. We have a 48-year-old male, chief complaint of pain in his chest, hard to pinpoint, hurts when he breathes, onset of about 2 hours. So there's a few things in the way he's describing his pain that, to me, can easily cloud our judgment. Anybody that says they have pain in their chest, we should be thinking or considering cardiac in nature. But when somebody starts saying it hurts right here, they point to it, it doesn't move, it changes when they move around, it changes when they breathe, oftentimes that moves us away from the cardiac presentation and maybe goes into, is this a pleuritic pain? Is this a lung pain? Do they have a cough with this, right? We start going down that mindset and we can easily become clouded. So I want to always emphasize that we should always think about the worst thing. Doesn't mean we have to overreact. We should just be thorough. So I'm going to ask this patient, is there pressure? Does it move? Does it radiate? Does it move to their back? Does it move? Ask very specific questions. Does it move into their arm, into their jaw, into their neck? Is there referred pain anywhere else that I haven't asked or described? So we're going down the MI route. What about aortic dissection? This patient is 48 years old. Ask if it moves into their back. Does it move into their shoulder blade? Check blood pressures on both arms. Very easy assessment. Check your pedal pulses. See if you have good, equal pulses in all extremities. Could this be a pleuritic pain? Absolutely. Ask about recent bronchitis, recent pneumonia, right? We're in the COVID era right now, recent COVID. And then start thinking about secondary things that could happen. Could this be a pulmonary embolus? Well, sure. Could this be pericarditis? Possibly. Could it be myocarditis? Maybe. There are some presentations that are secondarily that we may not have the tools to figure out. Again, we have to treat this patient the same. So we're going to do a 12-lead. We're going to start this patient on a set of vitals, listen to lung sounds, get a good history, think about meds, allergies. Again, keep reassessing. I don't think it would be wrong to treat this as cardiac in nature. Give some nitro after we established an IV. See if that changes anything. And think about other parts of their past medical history that we may not realize impacts this differential. Ultimately, this patient was transferred to an ER. He had a full cardiac workup. He had a chest x-ray done. He had a CT done. And it was found that he did, in fact, have a pulmonary embolus. They did some testing. And he actually has factor V Leiden deficiency. Now, I have this actual factor V Leiden deficiency. And so I found this case to be very intriguing. Factor V Leiden deficiency is essentially a genetic disorder that is passed from your mother, on your mother's side of the family. Women seem to have much more of a higher incidence of PEs, especially pregnant or on birth control with factor V Leiden deficiency. Men don't seem to have that many secondary issues with this disorder. I don't take any aspirin. It's not advised to take any aspirin right now. I've had multiple surgeries on knees. I've never had any issues, but there's definitely that possibility, and it's always in the back of my mind. So I found this case to be very intriguing. Let's actually do one more case, and we will wrap this up. Again, these are just examples, and the whole point of this podcast is to get us to think about complacency, to get us to think about what the eyes don't see, the brain doesn't consider. So you need to be thorough in your thought process. The most important part of medicine, it is not all the sexy skills that we get to do, the innovation, the pericardiocentesis, whatever you want to say. The most important part of your game is your understanding of medicine, your understanding of differential diagnosis, your understanding of clinical presentations, and your ability to critically think. That is the key. And that's what's going to get you the best bang for your buck as far as a clinician helping your patients. So again, last patient, 34-year-old female, calls 911, found with a Glasgow Coma Scale of 12. She does feel hot to the touch. Vital signs currently 112 over 67, heart rate of 134. Respiratory rate is tachypneic at 42 breaths per minute. She was last seen yesterday about 11 p.m. She is on Zoloft and is currently taking this without any missed doses, no allergies to anything. And did have a past COVID hospitalization times 2 weeks, was not intubated, discharged 10 days ago. So we have a younger female, calls 911, decreased level of consciousness, vitals, blood pressure is appropriate, heart rate is elevated, respiratory rate is elevated, last seen last night, and feels hot to the touch. So to me, this is screaming sepsis. It's screaming some type of infection. And if you go through the QSOFA criteria, we do have a respiratory rate greater than 22. We have a heart rate greater than 120, and we have an altered mental status. So this patient definitely fits that, but we know QSOFA is not perfect. And we know that we need to add some extra layers of assessment. And that could be end-tidal CO2, which looks at perfusion status, and lactate, that first hour lactate, if that is greater than 4. Those are great added assessment tools to add to our QSOFA. What else out there could make this patient present in the same way? Again, I found this case to be very intriguing because it screams sepsis. What about aspirin overdose? We know aspirin overdose, you could have an increased respiratory rate. You definitely will. You're going to be febrile. Your heart rate is definitely going to be elevated. And you're most likely going to have an altered mentation, especially that far from possible ingestion. We don't know when she ingested anything or if she did for that matter. My point is sepsis, aspirin overdose, a lot of the early clinical signs are very, very similar, but we forget the whole aspirin overdose aspect. Ironically, just to get to the end, the diagnosis was an aspirin overdose. ASA levels were 125 milligrams per deciliter. She initially was worked up for sepsis. So this is a very common problem. We got to remember aspirin overdose, the early onset, if aspirin levels are going to be fairly low, we have to always be very diligent about if you transfer a patient with aspirin overdose. Even if those aspirin levels are low, activated charcoal is essential even 3 to 4 hours post-ingestion because the absorption is very slow. Unfortunately, death was 72 hours after hospitalization. So this highlights that a patient that is younger, that has vital signs and presentation very similarly to sepsis, has a recent hospitalization for COVID, ends up having an aspirin overdose and ends up dying. And so these are just examples where we can easily go down the wrong road. We can easily get tunnel vision. We can easily forget that that cognitive bias, what we've seen in the past, what we've experienced in the past, that is so valuable, but it can also cause complacency. I definitely know that about myself. When I worked in Portland, Oregon, and we were running, 40, 50 calls in a four shift week, and you saw a lot of those, again, in quotes, system abusers, where they're calling to, they're homeless, they're calling to sleep in the hospital, to get out of the weather. It's those patients that become very difficult to manage because you don't know if they're telling the truth. You don't know if their presentations are real or not. And so you easily can get bit. And over the years, we all have seen this, whether you're working in the ED, you're working out in the streets. I think from the HEM side, we don't see that because we're, usually dealing with scene flights that are legitimate. You're not getting refusals. You're dealing with transfers. You have already EMTALA in place. You have a transferring physician, you have a receiving, you have an accepting. And so you don't see that. And so it's very easy if you've been out of the field pre-hospitally from a ground and 911 or fire side or in the ED and you're now flying as a flight nurse or flight paramedic to forget that. We also have to remember that oftentimes in the HEM side, we're told a lot of information in some cases when you come into an ED or you meet the paramedic on a scene flight. All that information is amazing. It's great. But remember, you need to still do your job, reassess your patient, start from scratch. You already have a lot of information that's been given to you. And so you don't have to look as hard, but don't get complacent. Don't have cognitive bias that allows you to have or makes you have blinders. Have a perspective. Again, the eyes don't see what the brain doesn't consider. Until next time, this is Eric, and I will talk to you soon.
Tired of boring Zoom conferences? Fast 21 will bring the latest technology in the virtual environment to ensure you have the most amazing experience possible. This year's program will take place May 11th and 12th, and with the same world-class speakers you've come to expect at the Fast Symposium, Fast 21 Virtual will blow you away. Networking, small group discussions, a complete vendor experience, and more. Go to FastSymposium.com to secure your Fast Pass now.